This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. All right, thank you so much. And my guest right now is Coleman Hughes, a 27-year-old, I don't know what you are. You're a jazz player, you're a trombonist, you're a podcaster, you're an author, you are a cause celeb, you're kind of an instigator. you've done it all, right?
I suppose so. I don't think I instigate, but people seem to disagree.
Yeah, wherever you are, trouble follows, which right. is pretty good. You went to Juilliard for a while, as well as, yeah. and then you graduated from Columbia?
Yep, I was at Juilliard for a few months, and then decided nobody really learns music in school.
Yeah.
And no one really learns anything in music school. So I decided to pivot, and I still play music to this day.
But. Right. Did you learn anything at Columbia? I don't know. You know, I guess you learned how to pull things off of poles and things like that, right? And demonstrations.
I learned how to pull down hostage posters and lost puppy dog posters and all the rest.
You were also, his podcast is Conversations with Coleman, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But he's also got a book coming out in February called The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. Let's start with that. What is the case for a colorblind America?
Well, first of all, I'm very happy to be here. I'm happy to be in front of a libertarian audience. Years ago, I remember seeing an article which said that libertarians of all political factions have the highest IQs. Mm. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
It's not true, yeah.
As somebody who, I've spent 30 years hanging out with libertarians, I don't know.
Well, I was hoping I wouldn't have to dumb myself down, but I
please, for our sake, speak slower, Cole. Sure.
So what is the case for colorblindness? In a nutshell, we are human beings, and despite the philosophies of people like Michel Foucault and others, who I know you have some admiration for, there is such a thing as human nature. One of the uglier elements is tribalism, the tendency to form tribes based around, any variable really, but ethnicity and race, to devalue the lives of others, to compete. And this has played out in history, everything from, genocide at the worst end to just everyday social mistrust at the low end. In America, unlike most places which have defined the concept of a nation around an ethnicity, whether people will admit it or not, America has tried to do something different, where you can come to this country, be any race, color, or creed, and define yourself as an American. This is a fragile experiment. It's not an easy experiment. It's something without precedent, and one of the challenges that result is that we all have to figure out how to live with each other and trade with each other and befriend each other and so forth without succumbing to our worst tribal instincts. Some of it's inevitable, but the question is, how should the state minimize this? Mm-hmm. Now, the answer that arose during the civil rights movement from people like Martin Luther King, Bayard Rustin, going back to A. Philip Randolph, was essentially that the state should not make any laws that take race into account, one way or the other. You should not try to discriminate against people, really for any reason. You should not try to discriminate to repay people for past discrimination. There should be something which I borrow from David Bernstein, which is called the separation of race and state. And in the long run, this is the best way to govern this fragile experiment.
So two things. One is, when you say, okay, so year zero starts now, because, it is kind of just a brutal irony and a paradox of America as a country that's founded on a creed rather than, an ethnic identity or commonality. And it also has the worst version of slavery, where from my readings, which I think are accurate, I'm not sure, but American slavery, the really unique contribution was that the children of slaves were also slaves. Like in most other societies, that was not necessarily the case. But, you know, what do you do with that? You know, that is a brutal, horrifying paradox, right? That on the one hand, you have people talking about, finally, this is a place where all men are created equal, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, we have instituted the worst form of kind of race-based caste system known to, you know, known to history up to that point.
Without getting bogged down, I would quibble with the worst form because, you know, the Arab world took some 14 million slaves from Africa into the Middle East. The reason there's no black people as a subpopulation is because they died. They were castrated. They didn't leave offspring. Brazil, unlike America, had to repopulate itself with more and more slaves each generation because they died off and they didn't bring families. So it's a complicated story. I believe that in the transition from the old world, where slavery was normal everywhere on earth, there was no such word or concept as racism, really, until about 100 years ago, because it wasn't a pathology, it was just the norm. In the transition from the old world to the new world that we all prefer to live in, which is a world of human rights, classical liberalism, and so
individualism,
forth.
Individualism, yeah.
I think there's bound to be a period of hypocrisy. So there's no other way to make progress, such massive progress, without there being a period of hypocrisy in between. And I do not hold that against the American project.
A lot of people now will say, you know, and we'll get to this in a second, talking about colorblindness as the goal of somebody like Martin Luther King or a generation of leaders in the civil rights movement. People now reject the idea that colorblindness is even possible. Where you obviously don't agree with that. Maybe you could explain why. And where does that come from, the idea that we will never get to a place where we are actually dealing with each other as individuals? We only ultimately see each other as markers of some group identity that overwhelms whatever particularity we might have in any you know, specific instance.
Well, first, I would concede that most of our ideals are unattainable. If I were to sit here and say, I want a peaceful society, no one would mistake that for the belief that we will actually get to a society with zero murders per year. It's never happened, right? We take that as a kind of North Star that guides us when we are choosing between A and B, whether in life or in public policy. I view colorblindness the same way. I'm under no illusion that humanity will completely eradicate the racial tribal instinct or racism or bigotry itself. But I feel that colorblindness, it's the North Star that we should use when making decisions about public policy, interpersonal, and so forth. As for the second question, where does this idea come from that it's no longer the goal? In the 60s, there was a consensus for a short period of time that colorblindness was the way to go. This was the high era of the high classical civil rights movement, if you want to call it that. Shortly after that, the country experienced massive rioting, the likes of which was basically not seen again until like Rodney King and then 2020. And you know, in the 70s, something started brewing in the academies called critical race theory, the brainchild of Derrick Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw, which basically agreed with the white supremacists on the fundamental idea that race is always going to be everything. These naive people that think we can aspire to something higher than being obsessed with race are exactly that. They're naive. And the only thing you should do in life is hunker down into the tribe in which you were born and try to get as much power as possible. And as Logan Roy from Succession said, life is a fight for a knife in the mud.
Yeah.
So that's what life is, except...
I was really hoping if you were going to quote HBO series, you would have gone with Sex and the City, but you know, we're not there yet as a society, right?
I heard this was a PG show, so... Yeah.
You talk about, you know, so race-based affirmative action or race-based policies are definitely out. Anything that is based on that kind of, a kind of immutable characteristic, I guess. But you do talk a lot about class-based programs that will help level things out or help people who don't have opportunities get opportunities. Can you sketch out what are those programs? You know, what do they look like, and what justifies that as opposed to, you know, colorblindness is out, but class consciousness is it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so fundamentally, I think that. And I overuse the word class. It's not really precise. Socioeconomics mm-hmm. in general. How much money you make, income, wealth. This is a much closer proxy for disadvantage than racial identity is. In other words, if you pick 10 people from the country at random, from Kansas, from New York, from, and you wanted to rank them by privilege, right? Which is a little bit of a, you can question the project to begin with. But if we're going to do that project, it's wiser to use their socioeconomics than to assume that the black people are at one end, the white people are on the other. To lump in a white guy from a, you know, proverbial trailer park in Arizona mm-hmm. with a black kid like me that grew up in a wealthy suburb of New York. Whereas using socioeconomics, you're getting closer, imperfect as well, but much closer to what we mean when we say someone is disadvantaged.
So then what are the kind of benefits that somebody would get, say if, you know, I don't know, they're lower middle class or they're low income, what are the types of programs that you envision that would be helpful to make society better?
So this is, I mean, as a philosopher, I have the luxury of painting the abstract picture without filling in all the details. But look, there are already social programs that are far more, you know, widely subscribed and popular, like earned income tax credit, need-based financial aid in colleges, that I'm not going to argue that they're perfect, but they're based on a scheme that is generally more correctly identifying the people that have less advantage
right.
than the regime of race-based policies that has become normalized over the past 50 years.
How do you define yourself kind of ideologically, or do you? And, you know, then what is kind of, what's the theory of government? Is government there to help, you know, is it a night watchman state where it's just there to maintain kind of property rights and to adjudicate disputes between people? Is it there to make sure that all people participate or can participate? Could you talk a little bit about that?
It's a good question. Truthfully, I found every theory of government to be insufficient. So I'm not a subscriber of any mm-hmm. particular theory. I liked Tyler Cowen's idea of, quote, state capacity libertarianism quite a bit, which was basically the idea that markets are fantastic. They are the source of the world's wealth, unlike many people would want to acknowledge, but a lot of our problems today necessitate having a very functional state that's capable of occasionally doing big things and right. doing them efficiently.
And helping out, I mean, you know, somebody who grows up below the poverty line and may not have both parents available yeah. or anything, like yes. we can give them a little to kind of,
sure.
so that they can participate more fully in society.
Absolutely.
Right?
Have like a safety net.
Yeah. Let's talk about TED. Okay. The conference you famously, and I say it's famously, it's a fascinating story. I suspect that many of you are familiar with it. It's partly famous because you've talked a lot about it and mm-hmm. you have, but You were asked to give a talk at TED about colorblindness. What happened?
So I don't know if you've all heard of the Streisand effect. You've heard of that? I think it was, I may be getting the details wrong, but I think someone took a picture of Barbara Streisand's house or something.
And it's what was more complicated. She tried to get the California Coastal Commission not to put a picture of her property on a website that was available to the public. And then by kicking a stink up about it, it went from having been viewed by like 5 people to hundreds of thousands of people.
So TED is the Barbara Streisand of, yeah. and I don't mean the singing voice. So basically, Chris Anderson invited me to come give a talk along the lines of what I've just been talking to you about. I gave the talk, and immediately on stage, I saw a few people that were visibly upset by it, sort of in the room. But largely, the crowd thought it was within the bounds of acceptable conversation. The next day, I start getting some messages saying there's a group called Black at TED, which is upset by my talk. Hurt, I think, is the word that was used. And I offered to talk to them, and you know, they didn't want to. So on and so forth. In a nutshell, what happened is that rather than release my TED talk normally, like they would any other, they asked me to agree to a series of kind of strange release strategies where they would tag a rebuttal to my talk to the end of my talk in the same video, or a debate that I participated in with someone else would be combined into the video, all of which I thought was unfair since there were no factual errors, nothing like that. So eventually we agreed that they would release my thing normally, and then 2 weeks later I do a debate with somebody. So I did the debate with Jamel Bowie of the New York Times, which you guys can all check out.
And that was staged by Open to Debate, which
yes.
I sometimes guest moderate for, and it's a great debate.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very good.
Open to Debate did a great job, as they always do, and it came out. But I'd put the whole thing behind me, but then Tim Urban, who's a great blogger, also happens to have given the most viewed TED Talk of all time on YouTube.
What is it about?
Procrastination.
Okay. I knew I would. I keep meaning to watch it.
So he tweeted that he's pretty sure TED was intentionally sandbagging, not promoting, selectively not amplifying my video, because every other TED Talk had, you know, minimum 400,000 views, maximum 800,000. Mine, strangely, had 70,000. It was the only outlier in the whole batch. And so, you know, I at this point, I went public about this because I had kept up my end of the bargain, and they hadn't. And it ended up bringing much more positive attention to my video and negative attention to TED. And there's also an interlude where, you know, Adam Grant,
University famous, of Pennsylvania social psychologist.
Yeah, big social psychologist said that my talk was inaccurate using a meta-analysis that really made no sense. And then he got upset when his name was outed as having tried to sort of deep six my talk, and it was a whole fiasco, which, you know, ended up bringing more attention to the whole thing. Yeah. But details aside, the crucial thing that happened is that TED, like many organizations, is caught between a faction that believes in free speech and viewpoint diversity and a faction that believes if you hurt my feelings with even center left, center right, or God forbid right wing views, you need to be censored. These are the same kinds of people who say that speech is violence, who say that they were actually hurt or felt unsafe because of my TED talk was the language that was used. These are the same kinds of people right now that see Hamas slaughtering children in front of their mothers and say that that's not violence, that's resistance, right?
But a poster of a hostage on a telephone pole hurts them.
Yeah. Or my recycled Martin Luther King is an attack on their identity, yeah. Right? So this whole language, unfortunately, Chris was not, he didn't put his foot down with his staff in the way that he ought to have. And I think he's taken a lot of heat, and Ted has taken a hit from the outside world as a result.
It's a lot of extra work and things like that, but do you feel like in the end it worked to the benefit of your point of view and your ideas?
I think it did. You know, truthfully, I was engaged in good faith with it the entire time. I was very happy to be invited to TED. I felt great with 99% of the TED community of all colors came up to me after the talk, and they thought it was interesting. It's really a situation of a heckler's veto. There's a tiny minority of people that do not believe such views should be heard, and they have outsized power. And when people aren't willing to stand up to it, it can make it seem like they're everyone.
Yeah. Did you experience that as a student at Columbia as well?
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
You were active and outspoken person. I mean, it's incredibly impressive. As an undergraduate, you were already becoming a public intellectual. But what was it like being at Columbia? Because that was kind of, maybe or maybe not, we're past peak wokeness, but you were an undergraduate there at a moment when college campuses were really into shouting people down, cancel culture, and things like that.
Totally, yeah. I remember I in college, probably my second year, 2017, I had a conversation with someone, and we kind of realized that there was this moment in college where you sort of come out of the closet with a friend as not woke. And you just, you put yourself out there and you hope to God that they're also not woke. And they're usually not. That's the thing. Most of the time, almost the vast majority of kids on these college campuses are not hook, line, and sinker woke in the sense that they believe speech is violence, that they believe asking somebody where they're from is racist, all of this stuff. But there's a radical, let's call it 5%. I would really call it 5%, maybe 10%. But there's a radical fringe that is very loud and very confident.
Why do you think, you know, at college campuses, it seems like the administrators are totally, those 5% speak for everybody, or... It just seems like the adults in the room or in the system have given up, and they're like, okay, yeah, we're scared too. Where does that come from?
I think you said it. I think they're scared too. You know, they have in this culture, they have quite a bit to lose, especially the administrators. The administrators have everything to lose if they get a reputation as a racist. The R word that could, if not end their career, it could derange the next 5 years of their life to have a single article on the internet calling you a racist for any reason. It doesn't have to be a good reason. I know there was, I can't remember which school in California it was, maybe you'll remember, but there was the example of the college professor, the Mandarin professor, who was teaching the word naiga, which is like a, in Mandarin, it's like saying almost. You'll hear if you go, well, we're almost in Chinatown, but you'll hear people say it all the time. If you say it quickly.
You know, when I walk through neighborhoods, I don't see race or ethnicity. It's all Little Italy to me.
Well, anyway, he got suspended for saying a normal Mandarin word that sort of sounds like the N-word with a soft A in English. Most people, they see things like this happen over and over again, and they think, look, I have a family, I have a life, I can't lose all of it, and they're not necessarily responsive to donors, administrators, so they do a cost benefit, and this is how a small group of people can take over a culture or impose taboos over a whole culture that some 90% of people disagree with.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple times Martin Luther King Jr. He's obviously one of the most important people in your kind of intellectual firmament. What draws you to Martin Luther King?
Well, he's really he's a rare figure for a few reasons. One is the depth and breadth of his knowledge. Mm-hmm. He has a great essay called My Pilgrimage to Nonviolence, where he explains in detail what it is that he learned from Plato, what it is that he learned from Kant, from Marx, why he rejected Marxism, how he integrated all of the Western European canon into his line of thought, and then also brought with it the kind of Baptist preacher element, integrated all of it in a way that was rigorous and inspiring to blacks and whites alike. And not only that, successfully implemented a political program, which is a totally different skill set. He gave the country goosebumps and changed the country as a result, fundamentally. It's something very few people could accomplish. Mm-hmm. And
are you religious at all or Christian at all?
No.
Yeah, because that is like a huge part of his rhetoric.
Absolutely. Right?
I mean, and you know, the figure of Jesus, forgiveness, yeah. Salvation, things like that. I mean, he offered a deliverance from sin, whereas it seems like part of the woke narrative or woke rhetoric is that we are all sinners, but there's no way to, you know, get past that.
So I'm a secular person. I'm an atheist. I can't bring myself to believe in any of the man-made books, but it's a big but. Mm. I believe that secular people want to sanitize the Christian element of Martin Luther King, because to admit that his Christianity was a core part of his success would cast doubt on the hope that secularism can stand on its own two feet. What do I mean by that? I mean, when Martin Luther King got up there and said, "In Christ, there is neither Greek nor Jew, black nor white, bond nor free." That made sense and gave goosebumps to the black public, to the white public, etc. He was speaking a language that people understood, not just in their prefrontal cortexes, but in their hearts. There's no secular equivalent to that statement that really resonates with people to such an extent.
Yeah.
And that's a problem for someone like me who is trying to update, in many ways, MLK, which is that I'm not a Christian. I can't speak that language honestly. And even if I could, the country isn't Christian enough to resonate with it. Now, in the place of Christianity, instead of rational Enlightenment liberalism completely filling the void, it has filled that void. But what has also partly filled the void is woke social justice ideology and Robin DiAngeloism, which, as John McWhorter and many others have pointed out, is a kind of replacement Christianity. Instead of original sin, it's white guilt. They're different ideas, but they're the same shape in the puzzle of the mind. And you know, it's a flaw that you could never. That you can never get rid of, but you have to make weekly or, you know, visits to whether it be church or a DEI session in order to constantly fight. In other words, you can never get rid of it, but you have to fight it your entire life, right?
Yeah. Another person that you've mentioned is Bayard Rustin, who was one of King's you know, kind of leading lights, is a fascinating figure. And I forget when it was, years ago, you did a video op-ed about Bayard Rustin for the New York Times, which is tremendous. There's also a Netflix, I can't remember now if it's a documentary or a narrative film about Rustin. Yeah, but who is Bayard Rustin and why does he matter so much?
Bayard Rustin's, he's one of my great intellectual heroes, probably more so than King even. He was born in Pennsylvania, raised by his grandparents, who he thought were his parents for most of his life, was a communist very briefly and then a socialist and civil rights organizer in the 1940s. And he was, you know, this is one of the interesting things, like Rosa Parks is remembered for refusing to give up her seat on the front of the bus and go to the back. Many people had done this before Rosa Parks. She was not the first to do this, right? Bayard Rustin did this 13 years before she did and got beaten to a pulp by the cops because of it. Rosa Parks was just the one lucky enough to make the history books. The country was ready, in other words. So he was right there from the beginning. He ends up getting involved with Martin Luther King and helping him start his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, though he omitted the word Christian initially because Rustin was a Quaker. He organized and led the March on Washington, at which Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. He read the list of demands at that event. And he was just a beautiful essayist throughout the entire period that very few people know about. An important fact about why he isn't known more is he was openly gay, and he was arrested. For being caught in a car with a man. And in fact, Dr. King was blackmailed by Adam Clayton Powell, who there's to this day a boulevard named after in Harlem, was blackmailed by Adam Clayton Powell, who threatened to expose a fictional gay affair between Rustin and King if they didn't cancel a planned protest on the DNC.
Rustin is incredible because he's unapologetically black and gay at a time when those were really dangerous. He refused to fight in World War II.
He
wouldn't even register to get conscientious objector status because he thought the state did not have that claim on him.
Although that's not really what I admire about him. And he later rescinded his hardcore pacifism. What I really admire about him is that he was more active and more passionate than anyone you could name in American history about getting black people full human rights. But he was also completely clear about the fact that race is not what's important. And when the Black Power movement came along in the late 60s and started saying that actually we don't want equality, we want more. We believe black people are not just equal to white people, but better. He was very clear-eyed in saying that this is evil. This is not something for radical chic white liberals to sort of pay lip service to. This is an evil on the horizon if we allow it to fester. And he drew that line very clearly in a way that too few people have courage to.
You know, one of the attributes of these salons that we're doing here, we like to talk to people who are trying to make good faith arguments, regardless of what your commitments are and things like that. And, you know, with that announcement, I want to talk a little bit about your podcast, Conversations with Coleman, which is remarkable in its, you know, for its equanimity. You have people on that you agree with. You have people on that you disagree with. How do you know, where did that come from? Because this, this is rare. Most people, you know, when you have a podcast, you have somebody on who you completely agree with, or else it becomes a kind of, Bill O'Reilly kind of shout fest. Where does that model come from?
I guess I always like to think as a consumer, I prefer to hear people disagreeing in good faith than two people agreeing in good faith. Most of the time, it's more interesting. It's also scarcer. So when done well,
it's a marketing ploy.
No, actually, I think it's scarce because it's so rare to get two people in public conversation when the cameras are on that are willing to strongly disagree about something without constant interruption and following kind of like the rules of argument, if you will, which is I'm going to steel man you, you're going to steel man me. I don't do it enough on my podcast. Yeah. I would like to do it more, but it is actually difficult to find the right partners. It's like,
right. Cause a lot of times you talk past each other or it's almost like you're not listening to one another.
Yes. And all of that's amplified when the cameras are on.
Right.
Turn the cameras off. Often you find someone is a different, totally different person. Perfectly
not
capable.
Not me, buddy.
Yeah, not you.
That's true. That's true. Well, some of the recent episodes that you've had on or rebroadcast after the Hamas attacks in Israel on October 7th, one of the things, that I find you reran an older episode with an Israeli historian, Benny Morris, who is an interesting figure because among certain Israelis, they hate him because they think he's too critical of Israel. Among non-Israelis, some people think he's an apologist for them. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about his message and why he's like a really interesting person to be talking to or with at this point in time?
Absolutely. Benny Morris is a rigorous and beautiful historian of the Israel-Palestine conflict, in particular, the war in 1948 and the lead up to it. He, more than anyone, is responsible for unearthing what we would now call Israel's war crimes against Palestinians in the 1948 war. For this, he was blacklisted, or at the very least, denounced by the majority of the Israeli academy at the time. And by the way, I kind of put war crimes in scare quotes here because not to trivialize them, but because the concept of a war crime was not really a thing in 1948. The Geneva Convention, to which we refer now, didn't happen until 49. So he unearthed with brutal honesty what Israel did in the 1948 war vis-a-vis expelling, some 70, possibly a little bit more, 70,000 or so Palestinians from their homes. But as he has gone on, he has not seen that admission as synonymous with saying that Israel is in the wrong. He has a very bracing honesty about the fact that the alternatives facing Israel at the time were expulsion of its a fifth column or genocide against its own people. Those are the alternatives that were being faced at the time. And the reason he's hated or criticized at the very least by both sides, he's hated by some on the Israeli side because he's exposed some of those things that many Israelis have not wanted to admit, but he defends them as the only realistic option that Israel had, right? And that's why he is called the worst possible names by people sympathetic to the Palestinians, because at the end of the day, and I think he's right about this, Israel has always wanted peace more than Palestinians have. There are atrocities to be found on both sides, but there's not an equivalence to be found on both sides in terms of wanting a practical solution, wanting a peaceful solution. So he has been very clear that Israel is on one side of that, while at the same time being very honest about the uglier parts of the history.
I think the figure that is usually given for displaced Palestinians is 700,000, right? Not 70,000.
700,000 are displaced. 70,000 were expelled.
I see. Okay.
Roughly.
Thank you. Yeah.
So this is the myth on the Palestinian side has been that they were all expelled.
Right.
That's not true. The old myth on the Israeli side was that none were expelled.
Right.
And Benny Morris has done the most careful research that roughly 1/10 of those that were displaced were expelled.
You also recently...
And I want to say, yeah. I want to add context to this because I think it's important. Millions and millions of people were displaced and expelled by wars in the 1940s. Millions of Germans were expelled from Poland after World War II when Poland took a chunk of land. The of those millions, the only people that maintain that they still have a right to return to the places where their parents or grandparents lived in the 1940s, the only people are Palestinians. So I think it's very crucial to understand the context of what war was in the 1940s before we had our modern concept of war crimes and the alternatives that people actually faced at the time.
You know, I found that episode particularly, you know, really informative and challenging and just kind of mind-blowing. You also did a two-part episode with a Brit named Andrew Gold about anti-Semitism and whatnot, which is fascinating. I highly recommend people check that out. And then this is part of what makes the podcast great, is that you asked your audience, like, who is a good person? Who's the best person I should talk to who would present a pro-Palestinian point of view in the current situation? And you talked with a guy named Yusuf Manair. How do you think that episode went? And did your audience respond well to that? Because it was charged kind of dialogue, but I also found that incredibly kind of mesmerizing and enlightening.
It's hard for me to know what the reaction is. I get comments that say things like, you know, Yusuf didn't acknowledge any of your points. I get comments that say things like, Yusuf was right about everything and you're ignorant about history. I don't know how to balance these two at the end of the day. I get many comments that are just glad to have heard a debate where both sides at least got a decent amount of airtime, a debate that felt a little bit better than cable news.
That is the soft bigotry of low expectations.
True, it really is. It really is. I'd like to do better. I'd like to do more of those in the future, and I'd like to challenge myself to, handle it better as well, because it's a difficult skill. I feel maybe it's been atrophied by underuse in our society, where we are less and less talking to people that disagree with us. But Yusuf is—he's someone that he doesn't even believe in a two-state solution. He believes in a one-state solution with a right of return. Again, this is something that no one would take seriously for any other group of refugees from a war in the 1940s. Right of return for every Palestinian whose parent or grandparent lived somewhere on Israeli territory in 1948, which would create a demographic majority of Palestinians in Israel, and in my view would lead to an instant attack on the Jews of Israel, a bloody civil war that would be horrible for both sides. But he feels that, and I don't think I'm strawmanning him, that if that were to happen, what would result would be a happy society where people hold hands and there's no violence and everyone has rights. And I think that this is profoundly naive. I think it's profoundly naive, and that was the crux of our disagreement. You know, he didn't really want to talk about October 7th.
Right.
I tried to get him to talk about October 7th and the war. He didn't really want to talk about it. Every time I brought it up, he would go back to the history, which is fine. But I also feel it betrayed a bit of embarrassment, because how do you defend?
Yeah.
How do you defend the dismembering of children in front of their families, the burning of entire families? This is not the behavior of freedom fighters. This is the behavior of barbarian jihadis bent on genocide. So I think it was a bit telling that he didn't want to go there.
We're going to open it up to the audience in a second. Are there, you know, either from race relations in the United States or elsewhere, are there models for, you know, the intensity of the Israeli-Palestinian situation, particularly now, but really for the past 60 or 70 years? Are there examples of good resolutions to this kind of, seething conflict?
I don't know that there are any good resolutions, but there are livable ones. The partitioning of India and Pakistan was absolutely bloody and brutal. Yeah. The atrocities committed on both sides were, in the partition, were akin to what Hamas did on October 7th. But that was a two-state solution. that was a two-state solution. And my point to Youssef is that the only realistic solution is a two-state solution, but unfortunately, Palestinian public opinion has not been able to let go of the dream of from the river to the sea, that all of Palestine will be theirs. So this is the core of the dispute, in my view.
Yeah. Hopefully, you know, that may not be true. There was in Foreign Affairs a piece that was written by people who run what's called the Arab Barometer, which had just, it's an ongoing set of surveys and public opinion polls of people in various Arab countries, and they had just completed a survey of people in Gaza. And there, a majority of people actually were, you know, said they were in favor of a two-state solution, and only about 20% said they believed in a one-state solution that meant getting rid of Israel. So we don't know. And of course, that's, you know, that's 1,000 years ago now.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a million polls.
Yeah,
it's hard to pick any one of them as representative, yeah. I think.
All right. Well, you know, and at, you know, in this room, I suspect, because there's a lot of libertarians, we probably would want a no state solution, which is equally unlikely to happen anytime soon. Let's open it up to audience Q&A. Why don't people in the back, sir, can you shout your question? And then we'll recap it.
Okay.
In a sec.
So your two heroes, King and Rustin, were both social welfareists to the core, levelers, if you will. Can you speak to that, to this libertarian audience, about why you think that is consonant with a sort of civilized society?
Okay. So the question was, your heroes are Martin Luther King and Bayard Rustin, I apologize in the grave for mispronouncing his name, but they were both social proponents of a large social welfare state. Can you defend that to a room full of libertarians?
No, I can't.
Okay. Yeah.
Look, I think Bayard Rustin was, as I said, a former Marxist. He never fully let go of his Marxism. You read him, he'll use words like lumpen proletariat to the end. He was in favor of, and Dr. King, a full jobs guarantee by the government, universal health care. Look, I think there's a lot of these are very, very complicated issues. They're issues for professional economists, I think, to work out, because as libertarians have correctly pointed out the past 50 years, often policies with the best of intentions end up hurting the very people they're intended to help. And that's not, I think that's probably a point that they did not see and didn't seriously consider, the effects, the incentive distortion effects of certain social welfare policies. Like I said, there's some are better designed, some are worse designed, and that's a problem for really smart economists and technocrats to figure out. How do we give people a decent standard of living who aren't really able to contribute much to the economy without messing up the fundamental market economic system? To me, that's the sensible middle ground, and it's not something that Bayard Rustin or Martin Luther King were frankly the most sophisticated about.
Do you, you know, with that in mind, do you tend to reliably vote? I mean, do you vote in the first place, and do you vote Democrat or Republican or something else? Or, you know, do you think we have like the right amount of government, or we should have more, or we should have less, or how does that play out?
I've only voted twice, and I voted Democrat both times, mostly because I strongly disliked Trump, not really because I felt strongly in favor of the Democratic Party, and I could easily see myself voting Republican. This question of more or less government, probably we do have too much government, but I feel like that is the wrong question, which is why I liked Tyler Cowen's post about state capacity libertarianism, because libertarians have tended to frame it as like the government is a number line and you either want more or less, which is okay. That's one way to frame it. But a more sophisticated conversation is like, what do governments really need to do well? How do we get there? And how do we cut the bloat where the bullshit bloat where it exists?
I will also recommend to everybody Tyler's book from a few years ago called Stubborn Attachments, where he said the two things that we should be betting on as a society is long-term economic growth and individual rights, basically. So, you know, and when you start moving away from that, you end up getting into trouble. But yes,
great
sir.
Colin, on your show, correct me if I'm wrong, but on the Ukraine war, I believe you had only one guest of a year ago who ironically was a debater at my Seoul forum, vigorously defending the Biden administration's policy toward the Ukraine war, with whom you seem to agree. Now that a lot of time has passed and some of us wonder, might a deal have been struck? Might many thousands of Ukrainian lives have been saved? Do you have a somewhat modified opinion about the Ukrainian war? Because I gather you did not have any of the many critics of the Biden administration on that show. Do you have a modified opinion since your interview with Kathy Young on the Ukraine war?
All right. So you had Kathy Young on your podcast, a longtime Reason contributor, author of a book called Growing Up in Moscow, Memories of a Soviet Childhood. She was pro-Biden policies towards Ukraine. That was a while ago. As things have played out, you know, what are your thoughts towards Ukraine?
So I'm sorry to bore you, but I don't know that much about the Ukraine-Russia war, so I don't talk about it. That's the boring reason why I don't.
And you call yourself a public intellectual.
Yeah, that's a thing you learn. Like as a quote public intellectual, people expect you to have an opinion on everything, including things you're uninformed about.
Especially.
Yeah, and sometimes like some people are happy to oblige.
Yeah.
So they do have opinions on everything, or they're just like geniuses like Tyler Cowen, and they actually have an informed opinion on everything. I had Kathy Young on in like the first month of the war, to give some general information about it. I know that Naftali Bennett, former Israel prime minister, insists that there was an off-ramp to avoid the war completely within the first month, and basically the US and the UK destroyed it. If that's correct, which I have no way of verifying, if that's correct, then that's heinous. But I have no way of verifying that that's true. Broadly, my view on Ukraine is that we were right to support them vigorously in the beginning. And now that it's dragged on this long, we should do what we did with when we supported Israel in the 1973 war, which is, yes, we're supporting you, but we're also going to structure our support so as to incentivize you to come to the table quicker than you might want to.
Is the goal of U.S. foreign policy to advance American interests, or is it to kind of help people who are being overrun to maintain their autonomy or self-determination?
I don't know, but what do you think?
I'm the interviewer, so
the way you ask the question,
my opinions on this are pretty. They're on the record. You can Google them infinitely. Another question.
I don't know.
Yes, sir.
So one of the, I think, really fascinating things that's happened over the last few weeks is as we've seen manifestation of anti-Semitism on various college campuses. In many cases, these universities have reacted by setting up new organizations or task forces or cooperative groups with other schools that are having the same issue, rather than turning to these massive DEI structures that presumably were created for this type of thing. And I guess that kind of, do you have a view as to whether these DEI entities have any redeeming value or are playing any constructive purpose in the university, or should they just be completely jettisoned if possible?
So in the wake, over the past couple of weeks, a lot of college campuses have been creating new task force to discuss anti-Semitism rather than going to DEI groups that already exist, which you would think they would be the ones who would be dealing with this. Is there a value to the DEI kind of industry on college campuses, or is it time to kind of admit they should be jettisoned?
Well, I think it's been clear they need to be jettisoned, and just, you know, I think there are DEI departments that employ 30 people that really should employ like 2 people at most. That's what needs to happen. There just needs to be mass layoffs and lower all of our tuition, and no one will even notice they're gone. Okay. But that's been true for a long time. I want to speak specifically about the anti-Semitism issue. The core problem is that intersectionality right now is the governing ideology of college campuses. At its core, intersectionality says that oppression occurs on multiple axes. Whites oppress blacks, men oppress women, straights oppress gays, and on and on. It adds up. So if you're a black woman, you're more oppressed than if you're a black man, etc. And that oppression explains outcomes. If you're poor, if your group is poor, it's because you're oppressed, by definition. The Jews are a huge problem for this ideology.
I don't like the way this is going, but, you know.
No, hold on, hear me out. The Jews are a huge problem for this ideology because any objective person that studies history knows that the Jews are among the most oppressed groups on the history of planet Earth. Everywhere they have gone, they have been hounded, pogromed, and almost exterminated in the 20th century. And yet, they do quite well, at least in America, right? At this time, which is the relevant cultural situation, right? So it's a fundamental problem for intersectional ideology. And so what does intersectionalism have to do when it sees Jewish grievances and Jewish people? It has to reject them. It has to minimize them. It has to say, actually, sorry, no, October 7th wasn't that bad. This is what intersectionality has to reject: the grievances, the legitimate grievances of Jewish people, in order to maintain its own integrity. And all of the DEI apparatus, they've imbibed intersectionality hook, line, and sinker. That's why they have no sympathy for the anti-Semitism that's going on right now. That's why when you have Jewish kids at Cooper Union that are barricaded inside of a library, in my own city, it's incredible. I couldn't believe it when I saw this, that this is not some other country. This is not some other place. This is the city I've lived in. And they have to lock the doors to the library because they don't know how to keep the kids with yarmulkes on safe from the mob outside. It's absurd. You would think, again, in a context where speech has been violence for 10 years now, that actual violence and the threat of violence would be the number one a problem vis-a-vis administrators, and yet they don't really care, right? And they haven't cared for years because their ideology is incompatible with having sympathy towards Jews.
Yeah. You are, you're African-American and Puerto Rican?
Yes.
Is that right? Which is which, father, mother?
Mom's Puerto Rican, dad's okay. African-American.
So how does that play out in kind of your personal identity? Because, you know, are you at war with yourself, or, has one, side won the struggle where, no, I'm Coleman because I get more oppression points, and I don't mean to be flippant like that, but it's, one of the most interesting and kind of, great things about America is that, we can build new identities that are, strung together from whatever we happen to be. But could you talk a little bit about how you deal with that intersectionality for yourself?
Look, I'm Puerto Rican in the sense that if you put a Hector Laveau song on, I probably know it. A guy asked me for directions to Brooklyn yesterday in Spanish, and I could answer him. Mm. I know good plátanos when I eat them, and I
have no idea what you're talking about.
Exactly. There you go.
It's on me.
So I'm Puerto Rican in all those senses, and I'm African American in many similar ways in terms of the culture that I know and grew up with, the music I grew up with, the food I grew up with, the family I grew up with. And No, it's there's never really been a war. Although one thing I did notice growing up is, when I was very young, people ask me, you know, what are you? I would say I'm half Puerto Rican, half black. And then as I got older, and you know, was forced to check one box over and over again, I increasingly just checked the black box, not as a decision, but at some point I reflected, like, why didn't that go the other way? That could have easily gone the other way. It's not.
Well, do you think it's because in America you're seen fundamentally as black, because just appearance?
Well, many Puerto Ricans are darker than me, as are some Dominicans. So I don't think it's actually an appearance thing. Yeah, it's partly how society sees you, but I also do think that we are much more sensitive to social status than we all let on. And I think the black identity in America has a lot more cachet than the Puerto Rican identity. And it doesn't take a cynical or conniving person to like subconsciously notice that and therefore identify with whatever is the highest status element of yourself.
Yeah, that if I may, I'm Irish on my father's side and Italian on my mother's. And when I was growing up, I identified more as Irish, partly because, you know, everybody wants to be Irish. It's a, you know, a bunch of beautiful losers who are poets and et cetera. And Italians were, you know, but then over time, and like when The Sopranos came out, it's like, I don't know, maybe Italians have a little bit of juice, right? But it's something similar. That's, I mean, certainly in status, not in terms of faced problems. Let's do one more. Alan.
Thank you. You mentioned 5% of maybe the students at Columbia were really the woke part. And diversity has always been something that I found very important, which you don't have. Diversity of ideas, freedom of speech, that was all buried for years. It's reasons people stopped giving to universities years ago. Now something happens with the anti-Semitism. Do you think that the major pushback against the anti-Semitism is actually going to go further and finally get people to start forcing the universities away from the lack of diversity and ideas and stuff that has been festering for so many decades?
So, you know, the anti-Semitism on display is alienating a lot of people. Do you think it may become a kind of flashpoint for a push for you know, a diversity of ideas on college campuses that have kind of gone missing over the past few decades?
From your lips to God's ears. Unfortunately, if you're asking me to act like a gambler and predict what's likely to happen, I think it will be a blip and a pushback, a blip and a short obstacle in what is the larger narrative of intersectionality's takeover of these universities. Unfortunately, I would not predict that it's going to reverse the trend. I think the trend towards intersectionality is stronger than the pushback against anti-Semitism that universities will feel in the next few months. Look, there were people on these universities protesting not against Hamas, but against Israel before Israel had dropped a single bomb in Gaza. When all that had happened was that Israel was brutally attacked and children killed and kidnapped in front of their families, people were already posting and protesting against Israel. That's that really is more the dominant culture on universities. However, you know, this again is to my earlier point. This is all a minority of students, but the minority of students that are intersectional is much bigger than the minority of students that are on the pro-Israel side of the issue, and they have more cultural power, which transcends, you know, the pure percentage or number of students that are there. When I went to Columbia, within the first month of becoming a freshman there, people would knock and go door to door and hand you out and try to get you to come to the BDS club. Right.
And explain what that is. That is not BDSM, as I'm sure most of you finished.
Although, yeah. No, but boycott them as sanction. The idea that we should boycott any goods and boycott any country that does business with Israel and so forth, the same way there was a boycott of apartheid South Africa. And unfortunately, it was an enormously attractive movement to kids. People were drawn in and recruited to this quite easily because they were basically told that Israel-Palestine is the same as apartheid South Africa and the same as Jim Crow in America. And this is what Ta-Nehisi Coates, our leading intellectual on race in America, said the other day. He said, you know, Israel's a Jim Crow regime. And he said when he went to the West Bank, it reminded him of Baltimore and Philadelphia. This kind of superficial, cartoonish analogy, which rather than defend what Hamas did and what Hamas is, you farm out or outsource your defense to analogies that are easy to reach for among Westerners, like Jim Crow, right? Once you label it that, well, we all know what to think, right? White people were the bad guys, black people were the good guys. So that must be what Israel-Palestine is. Well, South African apartheid, we all know what to think. This is how BDS has been able to recruit so many college students, most of whom couldn't tell you a single thing about the actual history of the real conflict that's being analogized to. In a nutshell, what they don't know is that the crucial difference is you know, Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela were not Arafat and Abbas. Martin Luther King wanted into America. Malcolm X wanted out. He wanted a black-only state somewhere, maybe in America, maybe in Africa. The Palestinian leadership wants to take over. That's beyond even what Malcolm X wanted in the case of America. It's a very different situation for many more reasons than that, but I'll just leave it there for now.
So if colleges, I mean, you're saying, you know, colleges aren't going to change much. The trend is going to continue with intersectionality kind of dominating discourse. You're coming out with a book, and I'll say the name again, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. In February, you podcast on a weekly basis, you write, I'm sure you're doing birthday parties. You are out there making a different case. Where do you see, you know, where, I mean, you obviously believe ideas matter. So where are you looking to have the most purchase with an audience that whose minds might be changed or where, you know, you start to change the way we talk about stuff, if it's not the university?
I don't think much about who the audience is, I have to say. I would love to have a sense of it, but I don't have a sense of who I could reach, who I should reach. I try to do my best to put my ideas as succinctly as possible and put them out there. That's really all I have to say.
All right. Well, I, for one, am a huge admirer of what you're doing. So thank you, Coleman Hughes, for talking of reason. This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie.